Sure, he's a 3-in-1 oil.
Yeah. Maybe you could bring that next time.
Yeah.
Okay, the case on the docket is Kersey versus Commonwealth. Mr. Hawk, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Judge, if I might reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, counsel, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, your honors, my name is Matthew Polk, and I represent Jasmine Kersey in this matter. Due to time constraints, would the court permit me to dispense with a recitation of the facts and move?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. We appreciate that.
In fact, let me make it even easier for you and cut right what I think is the part of the matter.
I duck.
I'm just, as I understand the record, correct me if I'm wrong, but at the moment of the seizure of this particular item, this dollar bill with the controlled substance wrapped up in it, it was in the physical custody of your client's boyfriend, is that correct?
It was in the custody of the companion, yes, sir.
Yeah. So, the obvious question is, and it seems to be the question that almost never gets asked in these cases, is does the Fourth Amendment even apply to that situation? Because you can't vicariously exercise someone else's constitutional rights, typically, unless you're dealing with a minor and, you know, you're the parent or something. But so what authority does your client have to assert a Fourth Amendment interest in something in the possession of another person?
Judge, I think probably the best way to answer that is by saying that Ms. Kersey did not, by entrusting that dollar bill to her companion, did not relinquish her reasonable expectation of privacy in it. She did not abandon the property. Consequently, simply because she entrusted it to...
Well, isn't Rawlings versus the United States precisely on point? And that's the U.S. Supreme Court. That's a case where a boyfriend entrusted his controlled substances to his companion to put in her purse, and the police searched her purse. He attempted to assert a Fourth Amendment interest because he entrusted these items to his companion, and the U.S. Supreme Court said he had no standing to do so, because it wasn't his Fourth Amendment rights that were impacted by the search or the seizure. It was the companion.
And Judge, I apologize. I'm not familiar with the facts of the Rawlings case. I guess my initial concern is, as was the case in the case at bar, the boyfriend in Rawlings standing right next to his girlfriend when the encounter with the police happened. And that, I think, is what makes this case somewhat unusual as compared to a case where you have a defendant, if you will.
Well, Judge Decker has been my friend for more than 30 years. If I entrust something that incriminates me to her, she certainly, it seems to me, has the right to do with it. But my Fourth Amendment rights do not extend to her once I've passed the property, even if there's a bailment, a legal bailment in existence, it seems to me. Fourth Amendment and bailment law is not congruent. If she elects to consent to turn that over to the police, given the holding in Rawlings, I fail to understand why I would have any say in the matter. Once it's left my possession, custody, and control, I've lost any expectation of privacy and any coverage by the Fourth Amendment, it seems to me.
Well, Judge, I would agree with you, with the exception that in this case, Ms. Kersey was still standing right next to the companion and in front of the officer.
How does that make any analytical difference if she no longer has possession of the item?
Well, I think simply because she entrusted it to the companion, in and of itself, without any other facts coming into play, doesn't necessarily lead one to conclude that she has relinquished her expectation of privacy in that item. In this case, she was present during this encounter, and as the Walls case points out, if she's present and doesn't object to the search, we would be in a different position. In this case, she was present. She didn't object. However,
I was just going to say, you might be hurting yourself.
And I'm getting there.
Okay, good.
She didn't object because her ability to object had been compromised by Officer Naylor's claim of lawful authority over her and the item.
She was arrested, right? At the time that she handed over the dollar bill. She was told she was under arrest.
She was told initially that she was going to be handcuffed and taken to jail by Officer Naylor prior to being allowed to make that phone call to her employer.
Right. It was only by the fact that she was very cooperative and that the officer threw her a bone that he actually let her go make the phone call before she was booked.
That's correct. The officer cited her politeness and her cooperation in allowing her to make that phone call prior to taking her into custody. To return to your point, Judge Humphreys, if she had been present, and this is the Walls case, and had not objected, as she did not, we would be in a different posture. But I would suggest to the court that the reason she didn't object is that the officer had told her. He didn't ask her for permission. He recognized she still had an interest in that item because he said to her, I need to see it.
Well, the Commonwealth has a litany of reasons why the Fourth Amendment is satisfied here. But we try to decide these cases on the narrowest and best grounds, and we don't deal with constitutional issues unless we're forced to. And so that's why I asked the preliminary question of whether the Constitution even applies to this situation, because typically the Fourth Amendment is personal. It applies to a person's houses, papers, and effects. And, you know, we've used since the Katz case in 1961, we've used the reasonable expectation of privacy standard to determine what the scope of Fourth Amendment protection is. Once you turn that property over to someone else, now in this case, the companion consented to the seizure, but the companion's not the one on trial, so we don't need to deal with whether his Fourth Amendment rights were violated, but presuming that they were, you can't vicariously exercise someone else's Fourth Amendment rights, so your client would not be in a position to assert his Fourth Amendment rights. So the issue is whether the Fourth Amendment protects the item once it's left her possession. And I don't know that certainly none of the cases you've cited, nor am I aware of a case that suggests that when you essentially create a bailment like that, in fact, Rawlings is exactly, inapposite, it seems to me, that you lose your Fourth Amendment protection in that item. You don't lose ownership of it necessarily, create the bailment, but the Fourth Amendment coverage ceases the moment it leaves your possession.
And I think I would agree with the caveat that when the defendant is standing right there, I think that defendant, as recognized in Walls, still has the right to object to what that officer does vis-a-vis.
Can you cite a case? Well, Walls doesn't, it seems to me, doesn't stand for that proposition.
Well, I think Walls stands for the proposition that when a defendant is present and not objecting to a request to a third party for consent to sake of police action, that defendant then cannot complain of the police action because while they were present, they didn't object to what the police
did. But the basis for that rationale is simply that the Fourth Amendment doesn't cover them. In other words, the third party, the second party, I guess I should say in this case, consented. And you can't override the consent. In fact, the name of the case escapes me off the top of my head, something versus Georgia, but where the police knock on the door without a warrant and are admitted by the spouse, you can't vicariously exercise Fourth Amendment rights to, in other words, someone could consent to a search who is a co-owner or co-resident to the common areas. And, at a minimum, if the Fourth Amendment applies, that seems to be what we have here.
Well, unless that defendant is present at the scene and objects. If that defendant is present at that house and objects to that entry, that objection overrides the consent given by the third party.
And your difficulty here is you don't have her objecting.
Precisely.
Tell us why that doesn't hurt you.
Sure. And the reason that she was not in a position to object is due to Officer Naylor's actions at the outset when he said to her, just as the officer said, using almost, if not identical words to Jean Laurent, when he said, I need to see it. That's not a request to search. That's a statement, I need to see it. And this court found in Jean Laurent that kind of acquiescence to that claim of authority to see the item in question does not constitute valid consent. Once the officer asserted or made that statement to Kersey, I think in a reasonable person's mind, she didn't have the right to object at that point. He had claimed an authority over her and the item, and with the third party sitting right there or within arm's reach, presumably, Having just heard that, it would be unreasonable for the court to think that that third party could validly consent. And what's important to also keep in mind is that we're not just talking about consent to seize the item in question, but also the consent to search the item in question. And what the officer said to the companion was, "Can I see that?" At which point the companion said nothing and turned the item over.
But at the point in time that the officer had the item in his hand, the record reflects that he described the unique way in which it was folded in addition to all of the other surrounding evidence. Wouldn't that then create the ability to have probable cause?
I would disagree, Judge. And this was a bit of a point of contention at the trial level, and that was I tried hard to make the record in this case when the officer verbally demonstrated how Ms. Kersey handed the item to her companion. And as he demonstrated her doing that, he simply testified that using her right hand with the back of her hand facing up and her palm facing down, at chest level, she slowly handed the item to her companion. And that was it. The Commonwealth had every opportunity to inquire of that officer all of the other facts that might have suggested surreptitiousness. But those were the only facts adduced by the Commonwealth. And as the Commonwealth was relying on consent, it was its burden. It was a warrantless search, a warrantless seizure. It's the Commonwealth's burden to adduce sufficient facts to justify the police action. And simply handing an item slowly in front of a police officer at chest level with the back of your hand up and the palm facing down, that does not suggest surreptitiousness or secrecy.
If I understand your argument correctly, it doesn't matter whether you're consenting or not.
Well, that's true, but I was answering Judge Decker's question about whether the circumstances as witnessed by the officer created probable cause to believe that item contained fruits of a crime. And I'd suggest that what the Commonwealth adduced at trial was not sufficient. Now, the judge found, opined from the bench that what he had heard constituted a furtive attempt by Ms. Kersey to secrete this item by sort of slipping it to her companion. But the problem is the evidence doesn't support that.
But that is a factual finding, right?
Judge, and that's something I was pondering actually before I walked in here. I don't think that it is. I think a judge can find facts, meaning what people say and what people do, but to then draw an opinion that a fact...
I got to say, I can't imagine any other conclusion that you could draw from these facts other than she was, knowing that she had just been arrested, she was surreptitiously attempting to remove from her person contraband that she knew would likely be found as soon as she was booked.
Well, Judge, with all due respect, you can't quite get there so fast because you have to view these things objectively through the eyes of the officer as it's happening. And the Commonwealth argued this at the trial court.
You just aptly described the manner in which she transferred it, with her back turned to the officer and the hand closed and so forth. And those are all historical facts that are in the record in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth that support the conclusion, it seems to me, the trial court drew.
And respectfully, I would disagree that those facts, as elicited by the Commonwealth, justify this conclusion that what Ms. Kersey did was secretive or somehow surreptitious or furtive. It seems if you were trying to...
What other explanation is there for her to pass this dollar bill folded in a unique way containing controlled substance to her companion under these particular set of circumstances other than to remove incriminating evidence from her person?
Well, Judge, as viewed by the officer at the time it was happening, we're talking about U.S. currency, and the officer has told you're going to jail. It doesn't seem strange to me that you would want to entrust your money to a third party knowing that you are going to be handcuffed and taken to jail. And again, it bears repeating that when you look at the chain of events, you can't look at the end result and then somehow view what happened prior to that through the prism of what was found ultimately in the dollar bill. You have to look at this thing objectively through the eyes of the officer as it was happening. And all the officer testified to was that as her back was turned to him, in fact, he didn't, let me tell you about the things he didn't testify to. He didn't testify that Ms. Kersey first started off facing him and then turned her back to him. He didn't testify that she somehow brought her hand down in a low motion in such a way that you would try to conceal what you're doing from the officer. She handed it at chest level slowly. Now, if an officer is right behind you and you haven't turned your back on him before doing this, and you slowly hand U.S. currency to a companion before you're taken into custody, that just simply to me, and with all due respect to Judge McCallum, does not seem secretive or furtive as far as that action is concerned. And obviously the judge felt differently. I would suggest that the record doesn't support the judge's opinion that what the officer demonstrated, as I laid out in the record, was furtive or secretive. Judge, I notice that my time has expired. Thank you.
Counsel, we'll give you a minute to rebut.
Yes,
since
yes, ma'am.
We asked you plenty of questions. Mr. Uberman.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. As the court is aware, the Commonwealth has made a three-pronged argument, essentially, and that's the first is that Ms. Kersey abandoned the property and therefore has no right to contest or no standing to contest.
Well, you use the term abandoned. I'm not sure that's a fair. I mean, even if it were some sort of a bailment, does it make any analytical difference in terms of the application of Fourth Amendment to a third party?
No, Your Honor. I think it dovetails quite nicely with the consent of a third party issue, and I think if
well, with or without consent.
Well, correct, Your Honor. But I do think that.
Doesn't she retain some expectation of privacy in something that she hands to a companion?
Well, what the Knight Court discussed, Your Honor, is there are certain objective factors that the court would consider with respect to whether property is abandoned. And, of course, what's abandoned under real property or personal property is not the same context in which we look at what's abandoned under Fourth Amendment property. Someone can retain a proprietary interest in the property but still relinquish their reasonable expectation of privacy.
In fact, in Rawlings versus Kentucky, the U.S. Supreme Court recited the following factors, whether, and this is the case where the defendant, Mr. Rawlings, stored his drugs in his companion's purse.
Yes, sir.
And the court determined, the factors the court enunciated were, number one, the petitioner never sought or received access to the purse prior to the bailment, nor did the petitioner have any right to exclude other persons from access to the purse. And the precipitous nature of the transaction hardly supports a reasonable inference that petitioner took normal precautions to maintain his privacy. And finally, a legitimate expectation of privacy by definition means more than a subjective expectation of not being discovered. And I mean, I don't know, that we have anything different in this case than we had in Rawlings, or the Supreme Court had in Rawlings.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's one of the arguments that the Commonwealth made on brief. And I think especially in as Rawlings, as in this case, the dropping of the contraband in that case was near contemporaneous to the police arriving at the scene of that location. And as again, one of the factors in Knight is how close, whether that abandonment of property is made in an effort to avoid its seizure by the police. And I think that's exactly what is before the court in this case.
Well, but this is a little different in the sense that, I mean, she didn't just throw it on the ground or throw it in a trash can or hide it behind the phone when she went to make the phone call. She handed it to somebody.
That's true, Your Honor. And the record, and I think the factual findings of the court demonstrate that when she made that surreptitious movement to what we only know as her companion because he's unnamed in the record, he immediately put it inside some notebooks and papers that he had beside him. So I'd argue that it's analogous to Rawlings in the purse scenario, and that she's putting it somewhere where she's hoping that the police are not going to find it. And I think for that reason, it is on point with Rawlings.
How is this, I guess, walk me through, why isn't this just a search incident to arrest?
It can be, Your Honor, and that's the third point the Commonwealth has made.
Well, let me ask about that, because I have a problem with that analysis.
Yes, sir.
Search incident to an arrest allows you to search the person who is arrested.
Yes, sir.
As I understand this record, the seizure clearly came from the companion.
It did, Your Honor.
Not the individual being arrested. So again, the basis for the seizure is clearly the probable cause that supports the arrest, supports the search, but only as to the individual arrested, it seems to me.
Yes,
sir.
So
unless you're going to argue that somehow the companion was also arrested, I don't know how you get to a search incident once you get beyond the person of the I mean, a search is to an arrest is a search of the person, and I guess arguably the so-called civil perimeter, you know, nearby, which I would suggest necessarily includes a person unless you've got independent probable cause to search that person.
Yes, Your Honor. I think my response would have to be twofold, essentially. There is a search incident to the arrest for her failure to appear on the civil habeas. That's what the officer initially comes out and says. You know, I'm taking you to jail. You're under arrest.
That clearly would authorize a search of her.
Of her,
no question
yes.
about that.
Yes,
if, the, if the dollar bill with the, you know, with the controlled substance was still on her person, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Yes, Your Honor. And as the court has mentioned, that also includes areas that are within the scope of control of.
But I don't know the single case that expands the Schimel perimeter to another person.
No, Your Honor, and that's why the Commonwealth also makes the argument, the alternative, that there was a second cause for arrest that occurred here, and that was that the officer had probable cause to believe that a felony had been committed in his presence, and that based upon his training, the totality of the circumstances, the surreptitious way in which the defendant handed the dollar bill to her companion, the folds that were exhibited in the dollar bill, that gave him cause to believe that there was some sort of felony.
Doesn't Grandison create some problems for you on that one?
Your Honor, I think Grandison is distinguishable for several reasons. Again, there it involved a detention, not a custodial arrest. And I understand this latter scenario, we would be talking about a detention. But in Grandison, the defendant there was a passenger in a car who had been pulled over in a high crime area. Was simply a bystander to the alleged traffic infraction, was taken out of the car by the police. He had a dollar bill that was folded in what the police described as an apothecary fold and a straw sticking out of his watch pocket, and the police removed it from his pocket. Unlike the facts in this case, Ms. Kersey exposed it to public and open view herself.
Not really. I mean, she hid it from the officer. That's
she
part
exposed
of it.
The dollar. At some
she,
point, I guess
she
the
took
dollar
it out.
Was exposed, but
true.
The contents.
True, Your Honor. The Commonwealth certainly is not making a claim that she had revealed its contents.
I would buy a reasonable suspicion argument, but I got to tell you, I'm pretty skeptical about probable cause, independent probable cause of a distinct procedure here.
Mm-hmm. And again, Your Honor, it's the Commonwealth's position. Again, the first abandonment, as the court has discussed, and then third-party consent apply.
I mean, I know you're arguing inevitable discovery, too, which seems to be the flavor of the month for the Attorney General's office, but you guys argue inevitable discovery and everything, and I'm not very much persuaded by that either, because that presumes a lot of speculation that things would occur in the normal course that I'm not sure would necessarily be the case, which is what NICS requires. So well, I think the Commonwealth's best argument here is either the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply at all, that's pursuant to Rawlings, or there's a consent by a person who is capable of giving consent here, and therefore the Fourth Amendment is effectively waived.
Well, I agree, actually, on both counts, Your Honor.
And let me ask you about that second piece that
yes, Your Honor.
That Judge Humphreys just mentioned. So the officer said, asked to see it, and so he took the dollar bill. But where is the evidence that there was a search authorized?
Well, and that's exactly, I think, what the defense argument is here, Your Honor. And I think the Commonwealth responds to that by saying, again, presuming a custodial arrest, there is no requirement for a search warrant.
So the only way you get to that search, you can't get to that search on straight consent.
Well, no, absolutely we can get to it on straight consent, Your Honor.
I didn't mean to
misdirect the court. No, in this case, it's the Commonwealth's position that because Ms. Kersey abandoned her interest in the contraband, gave it to her, who we know is her companion, in an effort to conceal it from police, she knew she was about to be taken into police custody, that therefore gave her companion, who was in possession of the contraband at the time, the authority to simply hand it over when the officer said to the gentleman that he asked to see it.
Actually, didn't you say, I need to see this?
Well, Your Honor, there are two different statements, and the trial court noted this. What he said to Ms. Kersey was, I need to see it. What he said to the companion on page 19 of the appendix was, he said, I asked the gentleman if I could see it. So there is a distinction, and I think in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the record would demonstrate that he asked the companion for permission to see what he was holding. And there's a long
line. Is your argument that given the officer's statement, I would like to see it, whichever way it goes, that the companion's turning it over constitute a consent to open the thing as well?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think there are cases, and the Commonwealth cited them on brief, that hold that an arrestee's response to an officer's instruction to let him see something by...
Because, well, I noticed earlier in response to Judge Decker's question, you circled back to the basic arrest of the appellant in this case, as opposed to the consent of the companion. And that gets back to a search incident argument, because that's the only thing that would justify it seems to me, if you're relying on the arrest.
In other words, he wasn't arrested. The one who handed over the dollar bill was not under arrest at the time that he handed it over.
At the time of the exchange note.
And the officer said, I need to see this, or I'd like to see this.
He asked
and
to see
assuming
it.
C is the operative word, obviously the officer opened
Correct.
The dollar bill. So that's a search.
Yes, it is.
Does C equal, I think what Judge Decker's getting at, it's a good question, is does the use of the word C convey permission to not only look at what it is, which is a dollar bill, but also to look at what the contents of it are?
Well, I think so in this case, Your Honor, because, again, there was no objection from either party. Ms. Kersey didn't object and say, no, don't look at that, that's mine. The companion didn't object and say, well, I can't give this to you, it doesn't belong to me. They were simply, they simply did what the officer asked, and that was voluntary. And the
so your argument is not that once he turned it over under this C principle, that then when the officer saw it, he had probable cause to arrest and could search incident to arrest?
Well, I want to be very cautious, Your Honor, because there are varying levels of arguments that the Commonwealth has
made. This is definitely a law school exam.
with respect to the third argument the Commonwealth has made, that there was probable cause to conduct the arrest, one, based upon the initial capias, two, in your, Judge Decker, in your question, we're now dealing with probable cause to arrest based upon the felony committed in the officer's presence. And
that's kind of a convoluted. In other words, you're saying that the second guy, that the man who had the dollar bill gave permission to the officer to see the dollar bill, but then once the officer saw the dollar bill, he had the authority to search the dollar bill based on his probable cause to arrest her.
No, Your Honor. In fact, he detained and arrested both of them following this exchange, and the officer.
So that poor guy just took the dollar bill, and there you go.
It really was wrong place, wrong time for Mr. Companion, as he's known in the record. But again, the officer testified that he saw during the exchange, he saw the folds on that bill, and given the circumstances upon which he saw that, it wasn't as though he was walking up to someone on the street. He knew, Ms. Kersey knew, that she was going to be arrested and taken to jail because he had just told her that. So again, this takes the case out of the realm of Grandison, as the defendant argues is on all fours, and I think removes it into the realm of, if we get all the way to a Fourth Amendment analysis, I do think the officer had probable cause to search.
So let's assume she had handed him her purse. I'm getting arrested, here's my purse. Mm-hmm. He has the purse. The officer says, can I see the purse? He hands the purse over. Can the officer then open the purse?
If the third party gives it to him and no one objects, I think so. I think that act of handing it over is essentially an acquiescence to open and examine its contents. In that case, obviously different from the one presented to the court, but and again, it depends on the circumstances. That's obviously a weaker case because here we have the officer seeing something that he's associated with the trafficking of illegal narcotics and the dollar. That additional piece of information wouldn't be present. But again, if it's a consensual encounter and they simply hand it over, I don't see that there's anything that would prevent the officer from looking inside of it. And the last thing I would like to address with the court's permission in the minute that I have left is just to argue that defendant contends, at least on brief, that none of the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment apply in this case, and also argued that no exception was argued by the Commonwealth and none was found by the trial court. And I think that's directly contrary to the record in this case. Consent is obviously an exception to the warrant requirement. A custodial search is an exception to the warrant requirement. So I did want to note that contradiction for the court. And simply again note that it's the Commonwealth's position here that, first, that this was abandonment. Ms. Percy lacks any standing. Second, her companion consented to the search, so the Fourth Amendment is not implicated. But third and finally, if the court has to reach the issue under an actual Fourth Amendment analysis, that the officer had probable cause to both search and seize the dollar bill. So I thank the court, and unless there are any additional questions, I'll rest on the remainder of the brief.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Polk, I said you could have a minute. We'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Judge. I may be stepping in quicksand by doing this, but I'd like to try to tackle your concern, Judge Humphreys, twofold with respect to the application of the Fourth Amendment and also with respect to this third-party consent that we've been discussing. The Fourth Amendment does apply because Ms. Kersey did not abandon her property. She retained a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. One, she didn't deny ownership of it. And two, while she physically relinquished it, she did so to a companion. As Judge Decker pointed out, she didn't drop it on the floor or slide it up by the phone in an effort just to leave it behind her. She gave it to a companion that she was with. So that, I would suggest to you, is not abandoned.
Well, I might agree with you, but for Rawlings versus Kentucky, which I know you're not familiar with, but that's precisely what occurred in Rawlings.
And I apologize. I wish I could address those facts, Judge. I just can't at this point. With respect to the consent by the third party, I'd simply say to the court that a third party can consent to a seizure or a search if the defendant is not present, or if the defendant is present, that third party can consent if the defendant does not object to that consent being given. In this case, Ms. Kersey's ability to object to the consent being given right in front of her was compromised by the confrontation with Officer Naylor at the outset.
But you have no law that supports that principle, do you?
Well, the principle as laid out in Jean Laurent, that when the officer says, I need to see it, that's a claim of lawful authority over a defendant, and that defendant can no longer validly consent to that statement. And so if you can't consent when that's put to you directly, you surely can't consent when what's happened next is he turns to your companion and says, can I see that dollar bill? So if I can't consent to you asking me directly, how can I consent in the next breath when the person is asking the companion to whom I've entrusted that item? So I suggest that the inability to validly consent applies both when the question was put to her and then moments later when it was put to her companion. Judge, I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. We'll come down and greet counsel and then